Today, swoosh, growth falls bigger and longer. The DFA Daily to the 25th of June 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour and with a touch of philosophy on the side. In today's post, we look at the latest IMF projections and some local data. They are not pretty. Global growth is projected at down 4.9% in 2020, which is 1.9 percentage points below the April 2020 benchmark, according to the World Economic Outlook forecast. The COVID-19 pandemic has had a more negative impact on activity in the first half of 2020 than they anticipated back in April, and the recovery is projected to be more gradual than previously forecast. In 2021, global growth is now projected at 5.4%, and overall, this would leave 2021 GDP some 6.5 percentage points lower than in the pre-COVID projections of January 2020. The adverse impact on low-income households is particularly acute, they say, imperiling the significant progress made in reducing extreme poverty in the world since the 1990s. And they're talking about a swoosh-shaped recovery, in other words, a deep fall and a slow, gradual recovery. As with the April 2020 projections, they say there is higher than usual degrees of uncertainty around this forecast. The baseline projection rests on key assumptions about the fallout from the pandemic. In economies with declining infection rates, the slower recovery path in the updated forecast reflects persistent social distancing into the second half of 2020, greater scarring, which is damage to supply potential from the larger than anticipated hit to activity during the lockdown in the first and second quarters of 2020, and a hit to productivity as surviving businesses ramp up necessary workplace safety and hygiene practices for economies struggling to control infection rates. A lengthier lockdown will inflict an additional toll in activity. Moreover, the forecast assumes that financial conditions, which have eased following the release of the April 2020 WEO, will remain broadly at current levels. Alternative outcomes to those in the baseline are clearly possible, and not just because of how the pandemic is evolving. The extent of the recent rebound in financial market sentiment appears disconnected from shifts in underlying economic prospects, they say, as the June 2020 Global Financial Stability Report update discusses, raising the possibility that financial conditions may tighten more than assumed in the baseline. All countries, they say, including those that have seemingly passed peaks in infections, should ensure that their healthcare systems are adequately resourced. The international community must vastly step up its support of national initiatives, including through financial assistance to countries with limited healthcare capacity and channeling of funding for vaccine production as trials advance, so that adequate, affordable doses are quickly available to all countries. Where lockdowns are required, they say, economic policy should continue to cushion household income losses with sizable, well-targeted measures, as well as provide support to firms suffering the consequences of mandated restrictions on activity. Where economies are reopening, targeted support should be gradually unwound as the recovery gets underway, and policy should provide stimulus to lift demand and ease and incentivize the reallocation of resources away from sectors likely to emerge persistently smaller after the pandemic. Strong multilateral cooperation remains essential, they say, on multiple fronts. Liquidity assistance is urgently needed for countries confronting health crises, and external funding shortfalls, including through debt relief and financing through the Global Financial Safety Net. Beyond the pandemic, policymakers must cooperate to resolve trade and technology tensions that endanger an eventual recovery from the COVID-19 crisis. Furthermore, they say, building on the record drop in greenhouse gas emissions during the pandemic, policymakers should both implement their climate change mitigation commitments and work together to scale up equitably designed carbon taxation or equivalent schemes. The global community must act now to avoid a repeat of this catastrophe by building global stockpiles of essential supplies and protective equipment, funding research and supporting public health systems, and putting in place effective modalities for delivering relief to the neediest. And the IMF has downforecast Australian GDP next year by 2.1% from their April 2020 estimates, and they lifted the 2020 forecast by 2%. In other words, they've pushed out the negative impact longer. As a result, Australian GDP outturn is now estimated to be minus 4.5% this year, which is a smaller drop than Canada, Germany, Japan, and the UK, which there is down 10.2%, and the US. But next year, they put Australia at a GDP of 4%, which is lower than most of those countries other than Japan. But remember, a smaller fall to start with makes the upside less pronounced. And separately, the CBA also came out with a revised GDP forecast for Australia today to take into account the earlier than expected reopening of the economy, the faster than anticipated rebound in consumer spending, and the material improvement in consumer confidence. There are clearly a lot of downside risks, they say, to the outlook, particularly around net overseas migration and the role of various stimulus measures, though they expect some policy changes on that front that will mean the government takes a taper-type approach. But some previously identified upside risks have indeed materialised, they say. In summary, the landscape is evolving very quickly, and things have moved in a better direction than looked likely earlier in the June quarter. Their internal data leads them to conclude that the contraction in quarter 2020 GDP will not be as large as previously expected. They now expect a contraction in GDP over the second quarter of 6.2% versus a previous forecast of 8.2%. The revision raises the profile of the GDP forecast for 2020, albeit with some of the recovery in household consumption previously penciled in for Q3 20 pulled forward to the June quarter. The overall impact is that they now expect a smaller contraction in GDP of 3.2% in 2020 versus a previous estimate of 4.2%, and their forecast for GDP growth in 2021 has been lowered to 2%. Versus our previous estimate of 3.2%. But it is important to note that the level of GDP that we expect in 2021 is now higher, given that we do not expect, they say, as deep a contraction in 2020. Importantly, despite the upgrades, the overall level of GDP, though, is not anticipated to return to pre-COVID-19 levels until the first quarter 2022. Their updated forecasts for the economy do not have any implications for monetary policy calls over their forecast horizon, they said. Monetary policy will remain highly accommodative over the next few years. Even as the economy improves, there will be a large output gap. That means that there will be a significant amount of slack in the economy that will need to be eroded before monetary policy is tightened. Full employment and underlying inflation within the 2-3% target band looks, they say, a very long way off. As such, they expect the cash rate to sit at 0.25% over the forecast horizon out to mid-2022. The three-year ACGB bond yield target is likely to remain in play over that time, but there is a risk that the RBA either increases the target or removes it in 2022. For as long as the three-year ACGB sits at the same level as the cash rate, the RBA is implying that the cash rate will remain on hold for the next 3 years. At some point, they may wish to signal to the market that their intention is not to leave the cash rate on hold at 0.25% for a further 3 years. They could do this by either removing the target or increasing the target yield. It's certainly not a concern for financial markets at the moment, but it is worth thinking about when considering the medium-term outlook for monetary policy in Australia. And they also updated their home price forecasts too, remembering that they had a 30% plus fall in their worst-case scenario. Now they say our expectation is that dwelling prices nationally will fall by around 10% as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. The increase in unemployment, falling rents, and lower net overseas migration were the primary reasons behind our forecast. But in our detailed note of the 17th of April, they say, we pointed out that there were some clear upside risks in the forecast. Specifically, we wrote then, there are both downside and upside risks to our dwelling price forecast. The risks both hinge on the length of the enforced shutdown and restrictions placed on economic activity. In a best-case scenario, government restrictions on economic activity could start to be lifted by the end of May. For that to occur, it would probably take several days of zero or very low community transmission of new COVID-19 cases. That is a possible scenario given the current trend in new COVID-19 cases. If that were to occur, the plunge in economic activity that we expect would not be as large, and the impact on the property market would not be as severe. Indeed, the fall in property prices would be significantly smaller than our central scenario, particularly given the extraordinary low borrowing rates currently on offer. That upside risk has materialized, they say. The upshot is that dwelling prices have not fallen all that much so far, which means that there is no material negative wealth effect to date coming via house prices. That is very important, they say, for the outlook for household consumption and consumer sentiment, as falling property prices weigh on overall expenditure. While property prices are still likely to ease over coming months, it looks more likely that the falls will be more modest than initially anticipated, they say. Auction clearance rates have rebounded to reasonable levels, and it looks like the impact of significantly lower mortgage rates is largely offsetting the other forces weighing on dwelling prices. And the ABS also came out with a summary of events and highlighted the reduction in household wealth in particular. They said that the March quarter 2020 saw a series of extraordinary events that buffeted the Australian economy, starting with bushfires and other natural disasters, following by the outbreak of COVID-19 and the subsequent imposition of restrictions. These events had an impact on many, perhaps most, of the macroeconomic statistics produced by the ABS. Australian and international financial markets experienced significant disruption from late February 2020 as a result of uncertainty surrounding the effects of COVID-19. Global equity markets declined during the quarter, including the Australian Stock Exchange, down 24.9%, and corporate debt markets became impaired. RBA monetary policy brought the cash rate and three-year Commonwealth bond yields down, which resulted in the Commonwealth government bond market stabilising. Significant amounts of government bonds were issued during the quarter, and large amounts of debt securities, including significant amounts of government bonds, were purchased by the RBA to ensure the financial markets remain liquid. These events impacted all sectors of the economy. The RBA and government policies were announced and implemented in mid to late March. While there were initial impacts from these policies in March, the most significant impacts will come through in the June quarter. But during the March quarter 2020, household net worth declined $204 billion, or 1.8%, and the average household net worth decreased $9,982 per person, or to an average of $428,585 per person, the largest decrease since the September quarter 2011. The impacts from COVID-19 on the Australian international financial markets from late February 2020 caused much of this decline in household net worth, with declines in superannuation and equity holdings of private trading corporations and banks. These declines were partially offset by an increase in the value of land and dwellings, particularly residential assets, and a fall in liabilities from short-term loans. The fall in short-term loans was a result of a decline in expenditure on travel, accommodation, restaurants and recreation and cultural services due to COVID-19 restriction measures and the bushfires. Restrictions on auctions and open house inspections, which were implemented in the last week of the quarter, had no significant negative impact on the value of residential assets in the quarter. By contrast, at the end of the first quarter of the global financial crisis, household net worth had declined to 2.6% from December 2007 to March 2008 due to negative impacts on both residential and financial markets. At the end of March 2020, household net worth was $11 trillion, comprising $7.3 trillion of land and dwellings, superannuation assets, and other financial assets, offset by housing loans. At the end of March 2020, total assets of superannuation pension funds fell 9.2%, the largest quarterly fall since the time series began in June 1988. The decline was slightly larger than the 9% decline at the height of the global financial crisis in December 2008. The largest assets invested in by superannuations are equities at 67.8%, either directly held or through units in investment funds, deposits at 11.5%, and debt securities at 7.2%. The primary contributors to the 9.2% decline in superannuation assets were falls in equity units held in investment funds, directly held domestic equity, and foreign equity holdings. Debt securities also fell, driven mainly by redemptions of government bonds. These declines were partially offset by an increase in deposits. While superannuation funds sold off some equity holdings, valuation losses drove most of the decline in value. And in response to COVID-19, superannuation funds partially shifted from debt and equity securities into deposits. And there were a number of reasons for this. Funds received the redemption of equity units from non-financial and non-money market investment funds, and there were more member requests to switch from high to low risk investment options. Further, funds paid variation margin on derivatives used to hedge foreign currency assets and prepared for members to request early access to their superannuation entitlements, which was part of the government stimulus package and took effect from April 2020. In early March, in response to the deteriorating economic outlook and financial market volatility arising from COVID-19, the RBA announced several policies to keep funding costs low and credit available to households and businesses. This included a 25 basis point target for both the cash rate and the three-year Australian government bond yield, a substantial increase in the amount and maturity of its daily market operations in response to the increased demand for liquidity, remuneration of exchange settlement balances, deposits, at the Reserve Bank to 10 basis points to mitigate the costs to authorised deposit-taking institutions associated with the large increase in settlement balances at the RBA, a three-year term funding facility at a fixed rate of 0.25% for ADIs to provide credit, in particular to small and medium-sized businesses. These interventions, they say, resulted in increased holdings of bond assets issued by government, ADIs and securitizers, and a large increase in ADI deposit liabilities. During the March quarter, national and state governments issued net $38.1 billion in debt securities, an increase of $31.4 billion from the net issuance in December 2019. The increase in debt was used to fund government expenditure in the March quarter on the bushfire response in Victoria and New South Wales and the government measures in response to COVID-19. Government policies implemented in April 2020 have had no impact on the March quarter outcome. The implications of these policies will be seen in the June quarter. These policies included the earlier release of superannuation entitlements, loan repayment deferrals for businesses and households, actions by the Australian Office of Financial Management to support non-ADA financial sector small lenders and securitizers, and a $40 billion loan guarantee scheme for small and medium businesses. ADIs, which predominantly include banks, are the key intermediaries that provide loans and deposits to households and businesses. Securitize mainly provide household housing loans. While the majority of the implications of the RBA and government policies implemented in late March will be captured in the June quarter, there are some early impacts on the loan and deposit estimates for private non-financial corporations and households. Private non-financial corporations, primarily large corporations, utilise their existing credit lines with ADIs to draw down on new loan commitments from earlier months. They also increase their credit limits from revolving credit facilities and drawdowns on those. Large corporations place the extra credit drawn during the quarter into deposit accounts with ADIs to prepare to fund operational expenses and possible capital investments in deteriorating domestic and international financial markets. The significant slowdown in household loans during the quarter was largely driven by ADI credit card loans, reflecting the weak expenditure on non-essential goods and services associated with COVID-19 restriction measures and bushfire impacts. Housing loans grew modestly, with drawdowns of new loan commitments for owner-occupied loans offset by existing borrowers paying down their loans ahead of scheduled payments. This reflects households taking advantage of very low interest rates Household deposits with ADIs increased by 1.3% in the quarter, reflecting households' preferences for safe and liquid assets in times of economic uncertainty, and the low levels of consumption of non-essential goods and services due to COVID-19 restriction measures. Unincorporated businesses placed the extra credit drawn during the quarter into deposit accounts with ADIs in preparation for funding operational expenses in deteriorating domestic financial markets. The deposit assets of banks increased 60.5% as the Reserve Bank of Australia injected extra liquidity into the financial system. While Australian banks typically rely on deposits to fund lending and debt issuance to manage liquidity, demand in the global debt markets plummeted in the second half of March quarter 2020 as institutional investors became more risk averse in response to the economic uncertainty created by COVID-19. This lack of activity reduced the ability of financial institutions to balance exposures to short-term deposit liabilities with long-term loan assets. And finally, there were more warnings from the ACCC, who do seem to have consumers' interests in mind, saying that consumers should look out for unexpected international transaction fees when buying online from major brands. Even websites with a com.au domain name or that appear to be Australian-based may in fact process transactions overseas, meaning consumers can get charged an international transaction fee even for a purchase made in Australian dollars. The ACCC says retailers may be engaging in misleading and deceptive conduct if Australian consumers are given the overall impression that the transaction is processed here when it is actually processed outside of Australia. Businesses should clearly inform consumers when they are likely to be charged an international transaction fee, the ACCC says, and has issued guidance to retailers about how price information should be presented to consumers. Following engagement with the ACCC, Nike Inc. has recently changed its Australian online checkout page so customers are alerted that they may be charged an international transaction fee. It is unclear to many consumers whether a retailer processes transactions overseas, so we expect retailers to make this clear to consumers on their websites, ACCC Chair Rod Sims said. Consumers who have been charged an unexpected international transaction fee for a purchase in Australian dollars from a website that appears Australian-based or has an Australian domain name should query the fee with their bank and report it to the ACCC, Mr. Sims said. If you're making regular purchases with overseas businesses, it may be worth considering a credit or debit card with no international transaction fees or asking your bank to block international transactions for certain cards. The ACCC will continue to monitor this issue and encourages consumers to make a complaint to the ACCC if they identify retailers who do not warn consumers about potential fees. And before I go, a quick reminder that on Tuesday, the 30th of June at 8 p.m. Sydney time, my guest on DFA Live will be Damien Klassen from Nucleus Wealth. He's an investment guru, but with a strong dose of reality, also looks at the property sector, so it will be an interesting session. You can ask questions live or beforehand via the DFA blog. Links are below, and mark your diaries. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.